Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Stephen Sewer, chair of the LGBT Forum of the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. Our presentation tonight is part of the club's month-long speaker series on the topic of protecting biodiversity and is sponsored by Ernst & Young and the Betty and Gordon Moore Foundation. Tonight, the Commonwealth Club of California is delighted to present James Workman, an award-winning author and environmentalist who will discuss California's offshore revolution. 80% of global fisheries are at risk of collapse due to decades of overfishing under the broken, open-access, free-for-all, race-to-the-bottom system. Pacific Coast fishermen are leading a bold new rights-based approach to replenish both the sea and their bank accounts. This careful graduation to a catch-share regulatory program involves 74 species of fish, and it's resulting in higher revenues, reduction in wasteful discards, fresher product, and greater transparency. Tonight, Jamie will reveal the roots, essence, challenges, and evolution of catch shares, tracing the seafood value chain from hook to cook and dock to plate. Jamie Workman is a leader in the design and creation of natural resource conservation markets for freshwater and marine fisheries. He is the author of Heart of Dryness, How the Last Bushman Can Help Us Endure the Coming Age of Permanent Drought. He was awarded the Best Book of the Year by the Society of Environmental Journalists, and he is currently co-authoring a book with the working title, The Comedy of Commons, America's Literal Sea Change in How We Govern, Value, and Harvest the Wild. In 1990, Workman graduated cum laude from with a BA in history from Yale, go Bulldogs. And he's been visiting professor at Wesleyan and Whitman colleges. However, he earned his real education by blowing up dams, releasing wolves, igniting wildland fires, guiding safaris, and smuggling water to besieged indigenous dissidents after breaking down alone in Africa's Kalahari Desert. His education continued with the birth of his girls, Camille and Louise, who are here tonight with us. After early years as an investigative journalist in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Secretary of the Interior in the Clinton administration, Bruce Babbitt, recruited Jamie to help advance national fire, fishery, endangered species, and river restoration policies. Overseas, he became an advisor to the World Commission on Dams under Nelson Mandela, and then a consultant to various corporations, governments, and international NGOs. Now based in San Francisco, he is Deputy Director of Environmental Defense Fund's Catch Share Design Center and co-founder of Smart Markets, a utility-based startup venture inspired by the Bushmen, which unlocks the scarcity value of water and energy. Please welcome Jamie Workman.
Thank you, Stephen. It was a previous occurrence here, speaking about, I think, 3-4 years ago. For those of you who've known me for a long time, some of you all my life, it may seem strange. You know, I've come here before with this obsession with fresh water, and I spoke about the resilient bushmen of the Kalahari and their ingenuity, their intricate involvement with nature and natural processes, and said, this is how we can learn from them about how to endure this coming age of global water scarcity, of permanent drought, as I'd called it. And and it was, you know, it was a fun talk. It was good interaction, lively discussions about, yeah, water and fresh water, and this is something we all need. We can see the rivers. We can depend on them. We turn the tap and connect that back up to the headwaters. But then a few years later, some colleagues at Environmental Defense Fund approached me and said, Jamie, you got it all wrong. I was like, oh dear. What? Was it about the Azaro system of the networks of the Bushmen who would exchange what they didn't use, turning scarcity into abundance? I said, no, it's not that. I said, well, is it their adaptive strategies, their coping mechanisms with drought that we all can learn from? No, that's fine. We agree with you on that. It's this part about the last hunter-gatherers that you're talking about? I said, well, you know, they are. They're in the Kalahari and just hanging on. He's like, oh, Jamie, there's about 45 million hunter-gatherers. And I said, whoa, where are they? Down in the Amazon? Are they in Australia? Are the Aborigines? He's like, no, Jamie, they're living about, 20, 30 minutes away from you. And that sort of struck me as unusual. It's like, well, where have they been all this time? They've been in plain sight and yet invisible, EDF told me. And these are the fishermen, the commercial fishermen that provide us with the fish, the wild-caught fish that we eat every night, whether it's in our fish sticks or our fillet of fish from McDonald's or our halibut steaks or salmon and so forth. And they can't stay invisible much longer because the stakes are just too high. It struck me, I didn't realize any of this, but 31,000 species of fish, more than the visible mammals and the amphibians and the reptiles and the birds all put together. So you're talking extraordinary biodiversity. And furthermore, it's another invisible world is the 1.5 billion people around the world who depend on healthy fish stocks for their survival, not just for a night out on the town, but for their protein to help them survive. So this comes to us as an incredible crisis and or opportunity. I discovered that there's a $250 billion industry around the world. It employs up to a 12th of all humanity, directly and indirectly. But there's an opportunity to increase these revenues fivefold into a $1 trillion economy for the poor and middle class alike, and to restore biodiversity around the world if, this is the worst pressure on that biodiversity, we can just end overfishing. Well, that sounds real simple. Let's just end overfishing. Simple enough. That's pretty straightforward. And I want to take you into this hidden world, what was to me a hidden world and was for many of us a hidden world, in a microcosm that's in many ways pivotal about how the global fisheries decisions are going to go. Because California's always been an incubator, but this is an area outside of Silicon Valley, outside of Hollywood, where we don't notice the kinds of innovations that are taking place on a daily basis. Is anyone ever here driven along Pacific Coast Highway? I'm hoping so. It's an extraordinary drive. It's not flyover country. It's often seen as sort of drive-through country. It's a must-do when any visitor from around the world comes. It's spectacular, almost staggeringly, comically beautiful landscape. But it's more than just scenic. It's more than just sort of picturesque. It's a place of chain of living communities in a struggling family predicament, some of them going back 2, 3, 4, 5 generations. And too often it's just sort of now become a place of shops, of hotels, of restaurants, recreation dependent on San Francisco visitors going up to Mendocino and on holiday or weekends or vacations and so forth, or retiring there from Los Angeles and so forth. And so these areas may depend on us for their livelihoods, for their shops, as a tourist economy, but there's this other return side, which is that we depend on them for something much more important, our sustenance. This is, in many ways, Steinbeck country. He captured the evocative nature of these places, mostly in books like Cannery Row or East of Eden. But I want to focus on one book in particular that connects this physical world, this economic world, and also a spiritual energy of these places along the coast. And that's the book, The Red Pony. Anybody here ever read or seen The Red Pony? As growing up, it's a wonderful story. When I first read it as a teenager, it was through the eyes of sort of the main protagonist, Jody, and it was a world of adventure, of animals, of interacting with the wild and all kinds of things that might happen. And I returned to it recently, no longer a child, as sort of a dull, sedentary dad figure in the book, who's caught between this child who's crazy about horses. I don't know if there's any children who are crazy about ponies in the room. His father, who was really grew up as part of the closing of the frontier back then. In his case, he was leading wagon trains across the country, and that was the part of him that he would remember for the rest of his life. For my own father here, it was growing up in these logging towns of old growth forests and just seeing the world fresh and new every day. And it's a poignant last scene where the sort of the child is sitting at the feet of the storytelling grandpa, who's describing this age of what Steinbeck calls sort of a collective ambition, crossing the plains. And I just want to read to you a part from it. He says, "Jody, every man wanted something for himself, but the big beast that was all of them wanted only the westering. And then we came down to the sea, and it was done." And Jody says, "Well, maybe I could lead the people one day." And Grandpa shakes his head. He says, "No, there's the ocean to stop you. There's a line of old men along the shore hating the ocean because it stopped them." And Jody's not ready to give up yet. He says, "No, in boats I might." And Grandpa says, "There's no place to go. The westering has died out of the people. Westering isn't a hunger anymore. It is finished." For 30 years, that passage, that chapter has haunted me. Those words, I want us to reflect for a second. I want to know what you guys think. Did the hunger, the pioneering spirit, the westering force that's larger than any one of us really die out of us decades ago, leaving behind a collection of lonely individuals checking our iPhones and Androids and Facebook accounts for some sense of real and meaningful connection? I'm here with evidence to argue otherwise. I want to say that against the odds, and in harsh conditions, and overcoming internal doubts, and external opposition, and politics, and economics, our westering spirit in California that drives the pioneers to extraordinary ideas did not die. It did not stop us at the edge of the Pacific. No. It pulled us in. It pulled us into the waves, and it is cold, and it is bracing, it is invigorating, and it's exciting. And that's what I'm writing about, that sense of possibility, that change, that innovation that's taking place in us. Now, to grasp why and how and who and when this revolution began and happened, you have to sort of trace it to the roots of any revolution. And in my mind, that often begins with hunger. That begins with the drive for food, of self-interest. How do we secure healthy, fresh, wild protein for all of us, not just now, but forever? Now, when we think of commercial fishing, we often think in California of salmon and of Dungeness crab, and I love those. They're delicious. But those are seasonal fisheries. The real fishery, I discovered, the most enduring and economically stable and the largest fishery off California and Oregon and Washington up the Pacific, is groundfish. You know, what the heck's groundfish, Jamie? Well, it sort of looks like this guy. where does it come from? Well, it comes from, you know, the sea and offshore. And as you think of something called groundfish, it comes from the bottom, the bottom of the ocean, near the coast. And what surprised me is this extraordinary diversity, the biodiversity. It looks like a coral reef offshore with all these different colors, 70, 80, 90 different species of groundfish that we live on. And we just sort of see the fillet. We see it in a supermarket wrapped in cellophane. But of course, it doesn't come from that. You trace it back, and you find with this diversity that there's huge variations among these different species. Some of them, you know, reproduce like rabbits, young and frequently and abundant, and others wait and reproduce late, and there's rare and there's few of them. And they all depend on the same habitat, these kelp forests and rocky scree offshore with a cold water environment that's extremely productive if treated right. The trouble is we don't often treat it right. And when it comes down to how to extract the right fillet at the right time from the right place and put it on the right plate, which is my plate, how do you do that? And the answer for centuries, of course, has been with difficulty. It's a messy process. Now, has anyone here, including anyone under 10, ever seen or played this kind of game? You can raise your hand. It's a lot of fun. What I'm showing on here is a piñata, and it is a wonderful metaphor for the ocean. You can imagine the sea as a huge and living and productive piñata that's filled with renewable treats that have value to us. Now, of course, when you're playing piñata, what do you want to pick up to extract your share? You want to use chopsticks? You want to use a surgical knife? You want to use a feather duster or a wet noodle? No. I mean, what do you want to use? You want to use a big, honking, hard baseball bat, a blunt instrument. And for the last half millennium, the last 500 years, that blunt instrument has been a trawl. Trawl net, a trawl fishery, trawl gear. That's evolved for one very, very good reason. It is extraordinarily good at catching fish. Yes, it scrapes the bottom. Yes, it churns up this silt. Yes, it has impacts on biodiversity. All true. But in the open access free-for-all, it's what you use to catch the most fish. The critics will keep coming back and saying, yeah, but you're raping the ocean. You're clear-cutting the seafloor. You're catching all the wrong stuff. And it's hard to deny that when you see photos like this, before and after where a trawl's gone through. But as crude and as lethal and as effective as this tool has been for the resource, for fishermen, it's even worse. And it's worse because it leads to, you know, this effort, just like with a piñata, to micromanage our way out of it. That the regulars say, okay, you got to catch these things. You got to throw them back. You caught the wrong fish at the wrong time in the wrong place. Shove them back into the ocean where they die and rot. It leads you, sort of like, you know, anyone who's been to one of these piñata things, to say, okay, well, you got to swing at it from further away. And you only get one swing. Now, you can't go. Now, you can go now. And you can imagine it's also extremely dangerous with people swinging something like that around, not just for the resource, but for each other. So rather than try to control where they stand, the speed of the swing, none of that works because you can't slow the quest to hit that piñata and get those treasures out of the sea as fast as possible, as much as possible. It forces these fishermen into a derby-style race for fish, which fishermen hate. It risks their lives. It wastes money. It makes them all unload and create this market glut so they're guaranteed the absolute worst price for all their efforts. It degrades the habitat, as we saw, and leads them to discard these, what they call non-target overfished species, or also known as bycatch. And yet that didn't stop more fishermen from getting in, more boats from piling in and trying to get the same amount of fish and competing with one another, hitting that piñata with more sticks and larger sticks and faster sticks more frequently than they ever can, until, of course, the inevitable results. That piñata starts to collapse. It all falls down. People get the last treat, and then that's it. As we said, sort of, okay, well, what do we do about this? Well, finally, you know, it got really bad. Fishermen and regulators and environmentalists agreed with Einstein that we cannot solve our problems with the same level of thinking that created them. We've got to graduate ourselves to a system that's better. And so we sat down and harnessed what Steinbeck called that westering spirit in a new direction. That new direction was individual fishery quotas, or what's better known as catch shares. And catch shares, you know, it's simple in concept, but radical in nature. What you're doing is you're saying, okay, here's the limit of the fish you guys can catch. You guys who've been fishing each get a percentage based on what your past history has been. It can be based as individual fishermen, a group, a community on shore. And here's the key thing. We're going to hold you directly accountable for the share of each species of fish, all 74 of those species of fish. And then, you know, we can innovate as we learn. So another way of thinking this is like, you know, a pizza or a pie, and how you slice that up for different people, different percentages based on their history, based on what they caught in recent years. And again, those may be groups or individuals. And there's legitimate concerns about these, obviously. They generated some contrast, some conflicts. What about the big guy beating out the little guy? Well, if you design these, you can make sure that no one has more than, say, 1% or 5% or 0.5%, so that you prevent that from happening. Okay, so you got caps on that. Well, what if everybody sells their value and then it starts to go up? It's like, well, let's ease into this. Let's delay the process where people can trade their share or lease it out. okay, well, what if the fishery changes? What if the climate change hurts it or helps it? Well, then you can build a buffer in here to make sure that there's going to be enough of a reserve for later. Well, yeah, well, what about community needs? What about people on shore that aren't fishermen themselves? Like, you can set aside some of that for them. It's all how we come together and design this. Now, it's easy to say, oh, well, that's great. That works on paper. So let's all plunge into this. And you can imagine, yeah, sure that happened because everybody adopts change very easily. Of course they don't. Change is very hard. It's painful. It's scary. The proposals of the catch shares ran against everything that fishermen knew and believed in, and everything fishermen were. They were used to competing, man versus man, as individuals, a contest against their rivals. And now they're supposed to sit down with these rivals as allies? They were used to a man versus nature where they learned to dominate the elements, risking safety if they had to. And now they can actually time when they fish. If it's storming and raining outside, they can stay at home and catch up on some sleep. They're used to beating the system. How do you get around the rules? How do you avoid detection? How do you get past the man, the regulator, the guys like I was at Interior or Commerce that set the rules? And now they're asked to sit down with these guys and help write the rules that's going to guide how they behave. And then there's man versus time, these kind of traditions that are passed on from generation to generation. This is how we've always done things, fishermen know. They're conservative with a little c. They're not early adopters in sort of Silicon Valley speak. They're not, you know, middle adopters. They're not even late adopters. They're the last adopters. And yet you're asking them to try something wildly new that's never been tried before where they live. So you can see that they were resistant, even as their numbers started to decline over the years, even as their revenues started to plummet. And I'm reminded of John F. Kennedy when a reporter said, "You know, oh gosh, how did you become a war hero?" And he answered, of course, like, "Well, I had no choice. They sank my boat." And that was happening to fishermen. Their boats were literally and figuratively sinking out from under them. Either they were having to abandon them, or they were having to sell them, or they were having their boats declared a federal disaster. And they kept losing money even as they did so for all the reasons we've described. It wasn't just the fishermen either. It was this whole economy that depended on them. The ice, the shops, the hoists, the processors, the restaurants, people like you and me. It all started to collapse until they got to the stage where they didn't have any choice. It was sort of that, you know, freedom is when you've got nothing left to lose. And so they chose that freedom, and that's when the revolution began that I'm going to talk about here. Now, the key to this whole process working boils down to, I think, one word, and it's the most valuable resource, even more valuable, I think, than natural resources and biodiversity, and that word is trust. And trust is one of those really elusive things that's just so hard to bring together, and that if you have it, it makes everything else possible. It's fine to say, okay, you get a secure share, you get freedom in how you catch, where you catch, when you catch, but how do we hold these fishermen accountable? How do we ensure 100% compliance? How do we verify that they're being honest? It's one thing, you know, for the bushmen of the Kalahari to all keep an eye on each other and manage things that way. But these guys are 500 miles in different directions up and down the coast. How do they trust each other, and how do the government and people on shore trust them? And the answer is kind of uncomfortable. It's Big Brother. And you say, wait a minute, Jamie, you're talking about getting out from this regulatory nightmare, and then you're saying what they need to have is Big Brother? And I want to pause on this a little bit. We're in the age of smart cookies on our internet and tracking and Google, and of course, National Security Agency has shown that you know, our emails and our phones are being tracked, and this generates a visceral reaction, I think, in all of us. Certainly does in me from this kind of data mining, because we have no say in it. Everyone says, oh, don't worry, we're doing it for your good. We're protecting you, we're getting you the best price possible. All this surveillance is necessary. But in many ways, I want to talk about how I quit worrying and learn to love mandatory 24/7 surveillance. If the fishermen were making this case, and I've heard them, they'd say, you know what, contractual spying will make us free. How is that happening? Well, I want to introduce you to the Fisheries Observer. It's kind of the equivalent if all of you at your firm or your work or your office one day went to the boss and said, hey, look, we're going to save commute time, we're going to save energy, we're going to make more money, we're going to be more productive if you just let us all work from home. And usually the supervisor's reaction is like, sounds interesting, but how do I know you're not just going to be, you know, cruising on the internet and eating bonbons at home all day? How do you prove you're not playing online games? And that's where the observer comes in. A human observer is on every boat offshore now. Every commercial vessel has to take an observer who's watching what they do. Now, this is an extraordinary thing to me when I discovered this. Like every boat, and it gets kind of interesting because there's Jeff Betancourt, who fishes out of Half Moon Bay, pointed out, he brought me on his boat. This is his wheelhouse. He's a big guy, and it's a small, cramped quarters. This is where he sleeps, or where he used to sleep, because having an observer on board, he has to give the observer his bunk. He has to make food for the observer. He has to help pay for that observer. So bad enough that you have to do all that. He says, well, Jeff, where do you sleep? I said, well, I sleep here. I roll out this pad in the wheelhouse and stretch out here. That's what I got to do. And I said, well, why? Why would you do this? Why would you put up with this? I said, well, it gives us more freedom. It gives us more flexibility. It lets us trust each other. It ensures that we're doing the right thing. We always known we've been doing the right thing, and this is a way of proving that, of verifying that. Now, this is hard to see. It's the same shot on the left as on the right zoomed in, but you'll see this sort of eye up there on the right. That's a camera mounted on some trawling gear at the top. And this is what it sees. This is what it's showing, looking down into the boat, so that it can now, with granular detail, focus on every individual fish that's caught, mark it by species, count it, track it, so that people know ashore what's being caught, when, by whom, and where. It's an extraordinary level of what we would think of being as intrusive, but it gives the fishermen that level of trust, that confidence, and accountability. And once you have trust, a lot of interesting things happen. To me, and to you guys, it might be, whoa, this is like Lord of the Rings. This is the Eye of Sauron. But it guarantees no overfishing. And that's something that consumers value more than anything. That we don't know where our pork comes from. We don't know where our chicken comes from. We don't want to know where this food comes from. But when we eat wild food, caught off California, we can know where every single fish that we eat comes from. And that's an extraordinary step in the right direction. Leads to the next revolution, which I call the, you know, tech innovation. You go, oh, fishing, yeah, that's real high tech. It actually is. All these fishermen are making their own nets. They're experimenting with new kinds of gear. This is Sarah Scamser up the coast with Foul Weather Trawl. Her business was on the rocks. It was really falling apart. Then catch shares came into place, and fishermen started to say, okay, well, now that we've got a guaranteed amount of fish out there, let's be more strategic in how we catch it. So she starts designing all these extraordinary new nets with excluders, with ways for the wrong fish to escape. So it reduces bycatch dramatically, and the fishermen invest in this. She doesn't just have California clients and Oregon clients. She has them from all over. I met Joe Panisi down in Monterey. He's got a camera gear on the back of his trawl now that's testing how it works, how he's never seen it. It's all been a mystery. He used to throw the gear overboard, drag it along the bottom, and see what comes up. Now he's realizing how he can do it much more efficiently and do so gently. It lets him fish shorter periods of time, which has an effect of saving him money, saving him fuel, saving him time. To give an idea of the fuel, it's not like, oh, yeah, you know, 45 miles per gallon instead of 20 miles per gallon. One trip over 2 days, he saved $1,500 in fuel costs. He takes 70 trips a year. There's about 130, 140 boats out there. This is pure profit for him, but more importantly for us, it means less pollution in the air above or below the surface of the sea. The third revolution taking place offshore is with marketing. When they can fish at a slower pace and they can focus on the product and the quality of the product, and avoid that sort of glut that depresses prices, all kinds of things happen. Fishermen start to negotiate prices directly with consumers. They can seek out new markets and new partners offshore. This fish here is called the short-spine thorny tail, which I'd never seen or heard of. But he, you know, Rob Seitz here gets really excited about it. It's like, why? Well, I started discovering that I could bring these guys back live. I was like, wow, that's pretty fresh. And he says, yeah, and there's a market for that in Houston, all over in Oakland. Vietnamese restaurants, and markets love this, and they'll pay top dollar for that. That's interesting. So he's finding he can catch 10% of the fish and make 100% of the profit, which leaves 90% of the fishery intact or to lease out to someone else, which allows more people to come in, makes a potential for new entrants. Another guy involved, Giovanni Comte, at Pacific Seafood, is taking it a few steps further. He's not a fisherman. He's that middleman. And he's starting to find all kinds of markets, including Google not far away, where they want to be committed to buying eco-friendly fish for their Googlers in the cafeteria. And tracing that back down, he's able to say, okay, this is how much we need, when we need it, and what people are willing to pay for it. That's something that the fishermen can then respond to. A lot of you heard of community-supported agriculture. This opens up the possibility for community-supported fisheries. And I'm only going to show one or two slides. This one is the one that excites me the most. I really get geeky on these things. But like most things, the revenues for this industry used to follow how much fish you bring in. You bring in 2 tons instead of 1 ton, you get twice the revenues. When catch shares came in place, an extraordinary thing happened. There was a divergence. It let the fishermen catch fewer fish and make more money doing so. That's never happened before. And that starts attracting new interest from all kinds of sources. The sons and daughters of fishermen, their father said, well, do you want to follow me into this dying, crashing, imploding industry, son or daughter? And they'd say, yeah, no, I think I'll pass, Dad. Those guys are starting to take a second look. How do they enter? You know, you've got all these quota that have already been allocated. How do they buy their way in? How do they get in? A lot of people say, no, it's rusted shut. You're not going to get any new fishermen coming in to the industry. Well, you should tell that to Steve Fitz. His uncle had been fishing offshore, wanted to retire, and Steve had been in New England and said, okay, I want to get into this. I see some huge potential using a Scottish purse seine net, which lets us be really selective in the kind of fish we get, in preserving the biodiversity and bringing fish back less damaged with huge, you know, value per product. And so I can sell it right off the boat, and he's doing that. But he only got in because there was some new bridge funding available from the California Fisheries Fund, which Environmental Defense Fund helped establish. And Phoebe Higgins here is smiling here with him because California Governor Jerry Brown had just recently recognized this as a new kind of finance. Now, with all the kind of creative financing going on in the world, this to me is an interesting step, in the right direction. Yet another kind of revolution is the insurance. Oh, wow, this is going to be exciting, Jamie, the insurance revolution. I want you to introduce you to Bob Dooley here. He is probably one of the most successful fishermen on the West Coast. And when you think of insurance, like, oh, has he got it covered? Has he got fire insurance? Has he got life insurance? Has he got crew insurance? Yes, he's got all that. But he needed a new kind of insurance because there was a new kind of risk that came from, you know, the canary in the coal mine, literally the canary rockfish and the yellow-eye rockfish, these two species down below. They're rare, they're slow to reproduce, and if he catches them, too many of them, in one of his fishing trips, it's a disaster. It's a catastrophe because it means he's got to shut that down. He's got to stop fishing until he can offset the impact there. And again, these are, you know, all over the place, you can fish as carefully as possible, you're still going to get some. In fact, the recreational fishermen offshore, pound per pound, are much more dangerous in terms of catching the wrong fish at the wrong time. So you have like the equivalent of one tricky marble in an otherwise bag of valuable marbles. And if each of you had that bag, you don't know if you've got it or not. But what you can do to avoid it being a real disaster for you is to get everybody in the room or 150 fishermen along the coast to pool the risk, to spread the exposure around to others. And that's exactly what the fishermen started to do. They came together. Their different Fort Bragg and Central Coast associations formed and started talking with one another and set up this risk pool agreement. where they revealed the data and they said, this is where I caught this fishy. You don't want to go there. That way we're all going to be better off. We're avoiding these no-go zones. And the fishermen can respond like that over 15, 20 minutes. Stop what they're doing, pull up their gear, and move somewhere else. In the process, they share the rewards as the fishery recovers. The results just after 1 year for biodiversity have been extraordinary. The blue zones are where the intensity of overfished species, there's been almost no contact. Just a few pockets of these red zones, and now that the fishermen know where they are, they know exactly where not to go. And this leads to the last revolution, which is in conservation. We all want to have scientific conservation, but there's only limited ways of doing so. Greenpeace version is like, we all need more marine reserves. And I think a lot of us would agree. We love marine reserves. We love national parks. We love wildlife refuges and so forth. But then the fishermen say, well, what exactly do you mean by a reserve? Does that mean I can't fish there? And in some cases, that's exactly what people want. The trouble with this isn't the spirit of conservation, which I think everybody shares. It's the actual bluntness, the tool that we use to conserve, of sort of putting a fence around it and keeping people out. Because that leads fishermen to hammer the outside just as hard to catch the same amount of fish. But once you start including the fishermen in the process, all kinds of new approaches can emerge, and they have emerged. They start saying, instead of my old boss and some of my colleagues, what he called, Bruce Babbitt called, postage stamp conservation areas, dotting the country and dotting the ocean, you get a very different picture that starts to emerge, more nuanced, more granular, more focused on conservation and avoiding areas that fishermen want to avoid just as much as the environmental activists want them to avoid. Because as fishing budgets, as management budgets shrink, as the budgets for science shrinks, who steps in? Who provides the data for the science? And it's basically these observers and Big Brother, these cameras that track the data of where people go and how they fish. This leads to new spatially managed risk, which leads to piecing together all the data points of where the fish are occurring, where the impacts happen, until this becomes this, and this recovery. It's only the other graph I've got. The recovery of all these endangered species, all these overfished species, start to bounce back at the end. Becomes this. I don't know if this picture was within one of the reserves or outside of it, but it's exactly what I think we all want in conservation. The proof of the pudding, isn't just in the eating, but in the recovering. This precise adaptive conservation strategy, as conditions change, as climate impacts take hold, allows the physical world to change. And as the physical world changes, it reflects a similar transformation inside of us. You may recall that westering spirit that united individuals to a higher cause that Steinbeck wrote about. I was happy to see, that it's very much alive. Michelle Norvell, she's a third generation a fishing family whose grandfather came over here from Sicily, rugged individualist, again, sort of conservative with little c. And she said some extraordinary things. To me, the most evocative one was this. I'll read this for the radio, but the days of the individual fishermen are nearing an end. That sounds pessimistic, except then she says, collective approach is the future. You don't often hear fishermen or, for that matter, loggers or ranchers or farmers saying something like that. But that's the kind of transformation within and outside that's happening. And then she went one step further and she said, we want to not, keep this to ourselves as a secret. We want to share this concept and model with other communities. I say, she's speaking not a moment too soon. Because the global fisheries crisis is a bit scary when you look at it as a whole. The kinds of peak harvest and then over harvest that's been spreading initially from California to Alaska to the Pacific and ocean and Atlantic, spreading everywhere. And 90% of California seafood we consume now is imported from somewhere else. So it's easy to say, oh, let's protect California, Oregon, and Washington, and let's just outsource overfishing to poor people and communities and weak nation states from Mozambique or Tanzania or Vietnam or India. California's offshore revolution has to spread, and I'm happy to say that it is. From the Gulf of Mexico and Atlantic seaboard over across the Atlantic to Europe and Africa and Indonesia and Philippines and even Cuba, we're starting to see people perk up with interest. Best of all, for Steinbeck, which we began on and I'll end on, is in the Sea of Cortez, a wonderful story coming out of there over the last 2 years. Now, he'd read about the log of the Sea of Cortez with Ed Ricketts, the great marine biologist. A couple years ago, the shrimp fishermen down in the Gulf of California, or Sea of Cortez, discovered something incredible. In their midst was this potentially huge fishery. It was the equivalent, again in Steinbeck, of this renewable treasure like the pearl. And whereas that story sort of ended in greed and breakdown and disaster, this story's turning out differently. The fishermen down there, rather than say, okay, let's get it all and keep it and destroy it and overfish it, they're stopping, they're stepping back, and they're coming up to California and Oregon, and they're saying, how are you guys doing it? How are you building trust? How are you tolerating and embracing and using this self-governance system, this self-organizing wonder that you guys have created, and how can we transfer that approach down here in the Gulf of California? And it's a wonderful story to me because it gives us another sense of what had happened, over several decades and the potential looking ahead. Again, I began with Steinbeck. I'll try to end with him. This quote from the log of the Sea of Cortez. He says, "That feeling we call religious, the most prized and used and desired reactions of our species, is really the understanding that man is related inextricably to all reality, known and unknowable. The profound feeling of it made a Jesus, a St. Augustine, a St. Francis, a Roger Bacon, a Charles Darwin, and an Einstein. Each in his own tempo and with his own voice discovered and reaffirmed with astonishment the knowledge that all things are one thing, and one thing is all things. Plankton, a shimmering phosphorescence on the sea, and the spinning planets, and an expanding universe, all bound together by the elastic string of time. It is advisable, he said, for us to look from the tide pool to the stars, and then look back to the tide pool again to guide us." And I haven't been back to Botswana, but I suspect the Kalahari Bushmen, though landlocked and never saw an ocean, would smile at the adaptive decisions, self-organizing systems, and westering spirit of their California brethren who hunt and gather our great renewable and rich energy from the sea just offshore. I thank you.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California featuring award-winning author and environmentalist Jamie Workman. I'm Stephen Seward, chair of the LGBT Forum of the Commonwealth Club, and I'm your moderator for tonight's program. We're discussing California's offshore revolution. I invite the audience to submit written questions for Jamie. So, Jim, it seems, as you were speaking, it seemed that in previous times, fishing was more akin to mining. And what you're describing sounds almost like agriculture.
It's funny. The perception is that, yeah, they just go out there, they extract all this wealth, they do their damage, and then they say, okay, we'll sell this and make a killing and move on. And you talk to fishermen, especially in the last few years, those who've gone under a catch share program, and they often compare themselves to farmers. And you say, well, they don't cultivate the sea. I say, no, but we fallow it. We let it recover. We let it rebuild before we try to harvest. We have this stewardship relationship with the sea now that we never did have before. And that's changed both, how they relate to it and the timing of their stewardship and what they harvest and how.
It's well documented that there's considerable consumer fraud in seafood. A well-known example is with sushi, that they'll tell you it's super white tuna, but it's really a fish called escalar, which is also known as the Ex-lax fish or the Olestra fish for the effects it has on your digestive system. Does cat shares pretend to a time where maybe there'll be less fraud this way?
I think so. It's not just seafood also that sort of creates this confusion. You've all heard sort of the pink slime stories and now wondering, you know, if this meat was grown in a petri dish or whether it came from a cow and if that cow was or steer was indeed free range. There's no way of trusting that because the livestock industry, and there's exceptions to this, but more or less they want opacity. They ban any cameras from being smuggled in, and if they are smuggled in, they ban them from being used. By contrast, the fishermen are saying, all right, we've got these cameras. We now have a way of verifying where this fish comes from and where it goes. There's a wonderful episode of this show called Portlandia I keep coming back to where the couple was at a restaurant there and they're saying, well, you know, this chicken, is it local? And the waitress comes to them and says, well, this is, you know, I think Colin was the name. This is Colin. It will be your chicken if you order it tonight. And they say, well, but where did it come from and how do I know? And they actually go out to verify it. And the beauty with cat shares and this, you know, eye of Sauron following people with 100% compliance is that we can verify that. We can know exactly where our fish came from every step of the way. In the Gulf of Mexico, they've got tags on the fish that can trace this. And there's, you know, a half dozen different systems for verifying this trace and trust capacity. And so the seafood, the wild seafood industry is really leading the way for all protein anywhere in the world.
I have a question in honor of Camille and Louise.
Oh, dear.
I think you may be uniquely qualified to identify this quote. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away while we devoting full time to floating under the sea.
Oh, dear.
Anyone in the audience? Little Mermaid, yes. Thank you very much.
I haven't been spending enough time watching that with my daughters, but I will rectify that this weekend.
So is cat shares an American innovation?
No. Yes and no. I take that back. There'd been a theory about it kicking around from in our economic circles. Some say it goes back a century to a Danish economist saying what you need to do is give each fisherman a monopoly. And Scott Gordon had said, yeah, this is the solution. And it really got sort of the debate underway with the publication of Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, where fisheries were seen as doomed unless you totally privatize them and lock them up, which wasn't feasible, or heavily regulate them. And this divided all approaches into either the sort of liberal or conservative approach. Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize recently, the late Eleanor Ostrom, said, well, wait a minute. There's a new and older approach. She would argue that catch shares are as old as time itself. Whether you're in Turkey or Hawaii or Fiji, that you have these communal approaches to fisheries, but they were, like the Bushmen, cases where everyone could keep an eye on them, each other. Where it really got underway, as best I can tell, was in Lake Michigan, of all places, a freshwater fishery where they had already the state boundary of water and county borders of water, and so they could close those areas and limit the access to fishermen and lay the roots for catch shares in practice. And that was, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s.
So is there someone wants to know, how is the red-eyed rockfish a canary in the coal mine?
It's a reflection of ocean health. Like most species that you know slide towards threatened or endangered status, there's a lot of causes: pollution, climate change, their habitat loss. But in this case, it's still a relic of overfishing, and those are all, of course, interrelated. It's a canary in the coal mine in the sense that it reflects the health offshore in California. Of the habitat, so that we're not just thinking of individual species, but the habitat as a whole that supports 74 or 75 or 90 or however many species of harvested fish. So it's essential in that that regard. What's interesting to me is some of these other sort of indicator species, as they're called in the jargon, or overfished species, are now starting to come back so fast, just in the last 2 years, that the scientists are scratching their heads and saying, wow, this particular species, not the canary rockfish, but one species, is at what they call 113% of its virgin biomass, which is a way of saying how many fish there were before humans came along. And so you're like, well, that's a kind of confusing calculation, but it means that it's recovering fast. And the fishermen take that as a sign that they're doing the right thing.
In July, a sportsman in Norway caught a 515-pound halibut fish, which may very well have been older than the man who caught it. Does recreational fishing integrate with commercial catch share fisheries at all?
That's one of the most difficult and complex questions. It does, because they're all going for some of the same species. In many ways, the fishermen in the Gulf and offshore California are going for more selectively, obviously the biggest. They're not just going for mass. And so the most reproductive sensitive creatures out there. And there's no accountability. There's no sense of what they're catching. That guy, of course, came back with pictures to brag about it. But most fishermen, and I count myself among them, pull something on board and say, oh, that's not what I'm after, and throw it back in. And as an individual, I say, okay, well, come on. I can't make nearly the impact of these commercial fishermen. There's only, me, and I caught three fish on a very good day, whether I'm in the Gulf or the Pacific or the Atlantic. And what I forget and what other recreational fishermen forget is there's 10 million of me. There may be 15 million of me. No one knows how many recreational fishermen there are in America and how often we go out and how many fish we get. And so what we're trying to work towards is letting recreational fishermen sort of self-organize themselves around how they fish and that accountability, much like Trout Unlimited or Bass Anglers or Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. So there's this ethos of good fishing in a reliable manner.
How many fishermen are there in the world?
That's also another difficult question. I was wrestling with my team, who are the data experts on that. The World Bank recently estimated, there's probably 45 million artisanal, local, commercial fishermen all combined. They estimate there may be, 100 million, 200 million recreational fishermen on top of that.
How many should there be?
These are easy questions. The economist would have a different answer from the ecologist, who would have a different answer from the fisherman. One of my favorite authors, Wendell Berry, has written about this in another context with farming. He says, the agricultural economists say that there is too many farmers. We have yet to see data revealing that there are too many agricultural economists out there, or how many there should be. I think what's interesting to me with catch shares is that the fishermen and the regulators and the ecologists can all help determine that on their own. Just like, the number of bushmen, they will grow and expand and enter the fishery and exit the fishery in response to the opportunity. But what we've done is we've aligned the conservation motives with the economic motives so that it's not an us versus them anymore in determining an answer like that.
Someone would like to know, what do you worry about with catch shares? Are there vulnerabilities or weaknesses in the system?
I think what I worry about may be different from what other advocates worry about outside of EDF, and there's plenty of them. And we're sensitive to that, Environmental Defense Fund, but is the idea that here's the answer, and now we've got the solution, we just need some problems to apply it to. I think, we're working with other organizations, Rare Conservation, to instill the potential for catch shares within different communities. And it's going to vary greatly from the level of sophistication and data and government capacity, whether it's Mexico or Indonesia or the Philippines. But ensuring that the catch shares is a homegrown solution is a difficult, obviously a very difficult solution, rather than saying, here's what you got to do, which is often the solution when you're sort of like a newly converted like me and say, this is fantastic, I'm really excited about this. You've got to install this in your own terms and on your own system. And working with people as partners to do that rather than in a paternalistic sense is one of the things I think I worry about. Against that is that you can do this fast enough, rapidly enough to ensure the biodiversity and the health of the people on the ground.
The next one is not so much as a question as a philosophical note. And it is, you are not just a drop in the ocean, you are the ocean in a drop.
I think I'll concur with that.
Are there parallels between catch share fisheries and other natural resources like energy or water, farming, forestry?
I think there could be. In forestry, again, Wendell Berry had talked about how they need a similar approach all along Appalachia, which has gone from farmland to basically forested woodland, and saying instead of having some big industry come in and say, we'll take this over, how to develop not just part of a global economy, but local economies that that value the resource, that use it sustainably. And of all places, I think, again, looking back to Native Americans, the Menominee tribe in Wisconsin probably has the best, in my mind, most sustainable forestry practices anywhere on the earth. And they do so because they're locked into this system. It's communally managed. They're constantly discussing how and where and how much to harvest. But they have that sense of tenure and stewardship on their own terms. So that's the kind of approach I think it could work in forestry. I think you're starting to see some of these coalitions forming. Mark Evans here tonight and my other colleagues from Interior have been working on habitat conservation plans that don't just try to manage for one species for land development, but include all the different species and spread around that risk of extinction and endangerment to say, okay, we can all work together around this once we share a sense of what the goal for us can be.
And is it happening worldwide? Can it succeed in international waters where overfishing is taking place to a great degree?
That's Eleanor Ostrom, who I mentioned earlier. She said sort of the commons can be a real problem in these open access areas. She was actually optimistic that we can solve the open access problem with climate change, with the emissions that we throw up in the air and pollute and say, well, it's for some future generation or other country to adapt to. But she said the hardest thing for her was fisheries, was open deep water fisheries. Again, I have some reason for hope. I'm maybe an incurable optimist like my dad. But I spent some time with the yellowtail and big eye tuna fishery, which is a deep water pelagic, they call it, species, and harvesting in Honolulu. And they are doing an incredibly sustainable job of doing so in many ways through transparency, through back and forth negotiation with each other and with the buyers to make sure that the value of the fishery is protected for the long term. That, I think, offers a good model. We're also working on sardines. Sarah McTee here has been looking, how does, we've seen Cannery Row and the sad story there, but there's this wonderful story, again, emerging invisibly offshore from Mexico across America into Canada. These sardines, where are they going? Are they coming back? How can we harvest them in a way of sort of that crosses ocean borders? And another of my colleagues in the Gulf of Mexico are working with Cuba and Mexico to protect sharks, which, again, I didn't know about this until a few years ago, but are an incredibly overfished species because of the finning that takes place and makes them really valuable for somebody who's trying to support their kids. We're working with Cuba and Mexico to say, okay, people will catch these. Let's see how we can manage them in a way between our three countries that reduces the waste and the excess damage to these these open ocean pelagic species.
Jamie, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one more question. Can you tell us a fish story?
Oh, dear. Not one where I'm fishing, because anyone who's seen me fish knows that those are very short and sad stories. I've shown some proudly some pictures of my fly fishing prowess, and they're saying, "Oh, is that what you're using for bait, Jamie?" I was like, "No, that's what I caught." I have gone out with some fishermen and come away with an extraordinary respect again for these hunter gatherers, whether it was a young boy I went out with in Indonesia about 10 years ago, and the kind of intricate knowledge that he had been, you know, learned from his father and had been passed down from generation to generation. These are the guys I'm trying to think of when we move toward. He caught two mahi-mahi despite my bad luck aboard. Other fishing with my dad for rockfish, as I realized retrospectively, offshore maybe 30 years ago, and the captain took us out to a offshore oil rig, and you think, oh gosh, well that's where the fish are, that's where they're growing, and there's a wonderful story there that we're starting to use these once they become decrepit and no longer producing, to become virtual reefs or real reefs for restoring the fish out there. So most of my fish stories would go in admiration of the fishermen around me rather than the sad, sorry luck of my own fishing lack of skills. But I'm going to keep working on that once I can work with some of these recreational fishermen on a restorative catch share with them.
Very special thanks to Jamie Workman for sharing his thoughts on California's offshore revolution. I'd also like to thank our audience here via the internet and on radio, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where the place you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you, sir.